Hi, and welcome to the next in the leadership series of What's Next in Corporate Real Estate. My name is Michael Kramer at Cushman & Wakefield, and it is really my pleasure to have the Chief Marketing Officer from Cushman & Wakefield in the studio. Comes from Chicago. Brad, welcome to the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to see you.
Yeah, it's good to have you over here on a trip. I thought what we'd do today is maybe kick off and talk a little bit about what you did at university, because you're obviously not a real estate professional. But in the conversations we've been having to date, I know there's a lot of really interesting things that you've been thinking about and doing which relate to how people should think about the modern world of real estate and what's next. So maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about what and why you did at university, and then how you got into the property game.
Yeah, it's funny. It's probably, I don't know, the least traditional route I could ever think of to be in the position that I'm at today. But that's how life goes sometimes. So I've had a couple of goes at university. When I started, I was something similar to what we're doing today. I was an audio production major at Columbia College in Chicago. And the reason I was an audio production major is because coming out of grammar school, I was in a band and wanted to produce records for a living. And I thought, you know, that was going to be the bee's knees. So I go to an audio school. The band actually was fairly successful in that limited way, but so much so that we dropped out of school. We bought a van, we toured around a bit, and had a good bit of fun when we were about 20, 21 years old. So I'd done that. I started working in the production industry and was producing the likes of Motown bands like The Temptations and Four Tops at Indiana casinos for a little bit. And it was a small company, and my boss, a guy named Steve at the time, said to me, you know, when you go back to, because I had it in my head, I would go back to production school and finish my degree. He said, when you go back to school, think about what you're going to study. If you're going to study production, you'll basically come back and get the same job that you have today or that job in a different company. He said, why don't you get a business degree, because you seem to have a good head for business. And so, yeah, so that rebooted my college experience. I went back to university and I met a guy who was taking a summer school class. And I think I was literally producing the Oak Ridge Boys or something for a 4-night stand. And I had to take time off in between sets to work in school. So I went to summer school at Purdue University, and I had a night class, and it was introduction to PR, intro to PR. And the guy who was teaching it, he had just come out of the corporate world, but he had sort of this kind of hippie kind of demeanor to him, and everything he described about what a PR professional should be. And he really taught it from a classical, almost a Greek rhetoric point of view. And so he believed the modern profession of PR not to be sort of maybe the image or reputation when you think of people who, you know, come out in front of the camera when the factory's on fire and tell you the factory's not on fire. Like, he believed that, you know, real PR practitioners were ethical and that they were orating their company's position into the public sphere amidst all the people that were surrounded by the company. So when I met him and understood kind of what that could look like, I thought, wow, this is really cool. And I remember that first lecture, I pulled him aside after the class was over. I said, hey, everything you just talked about, that's what I want to do with my life. I've been sort of trying to figure it out over the last couple of years. I want to be like one of you when I grow up. And he's like, okay, great. I'm like, well, what should I do? Should I need to fill out a form, or there must be a slip or something? And he was clearly getting irritated by the whole conversation. And he said, look, I'm headed back to my office right now. I'm going to play some guitar. And unless you play guitar and want to join me, like, we'll deal with this, you know, another time. I was like, I do play guitar. He goes, do you know any Dylan? And I was like, no, but I'm happy to learn. And it was probably 10 years after that, he was giving the toast at my wedding, because he introduced my wife and I, and he's a dear friend of this day and has been a mentor. So that was one of those pivot moments, right, where you just sort of look back and go, wow, my whole life got kind of set in a different direction at that minute.
Yeah, and I know you got into a startup later on, but it's funny when you're talking about a band and going on shows, it's kind of like the original startup before people were doing things in garages on the West Coast. There you were, like a lot of other kids, kind of living your dream, dropping out of school and going off and trying to make money or at least have fun and run around America.
I think I had a little different. I always wanted to do, and you know, it was my creativity and drive, I think, that made all of that happen at that point in my life, in terms of, you know, putting out a record and marketing the record and building a website in 1995, which was a very, you know, kind of old school process back then. But I had too much of that, like, Midwestern U.S. German pragmatism, I think, in me to actually be okay with the idea that I would live in a van and make that my like life's work. And so, so after I finished that, you know, the degree, the public relations degree, got a call from that same professor who said, hey, one of the alumni of this program just rang and they're looking for somebody right out of school, and it's a great PR job. The company has a great reputation. I was like, send me in. What do you got? And he said, it's a commercial contractor. I was like, what do you mean contractor? It's a commercial construction company. They're big. They do work, you know, in different countries, but you should go talk to her. And I thought, that's the last thing I want to do with a PR degree is work for a construction company.
What, like, come down from bands to construction.
And I thought, you know, I wanted to go to New York. I wanted to do the big, you know, advertising agency thing and really make a go at it. And so I walk in, I meet the I meet some of the leadership, and I get my first job out of school. And I absolutely fell in love with the industry, the whole kind of built environment, and just really to unpack that whole process of how, you know, a piece of land turns into something that people use to live and to work in. And it was really cool. I got the bug, I guess, and I haven't really left the industry since.
Great. Yeah, that's quite a story and quite a different one to most people and the way they get into this game. And I think one of the things we were talking about is exactly that, is how much the industry has changed from whenever that was. So what year was that that you started work?
So that was in 2001. It was just after the recession was setting in. 9/11 had just happened. It was sort of a tumultuous time. So it was just almost 20 years ago.
Wow. So maybe we should, maybe we can touch on and talk a little bit about what you've seen that's changed in the industry from that period, 2000, 2001 to today, because presumably in the role that you have, marketing and talking about change is very much central to what you have to do. It's not just about brochures and videos of buildings and all of that good stuff. I mean, you're really involved in the, what does it mean for us as a business, but also us as working in the industry.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny sometimes, when I think back to 20 years ago and the kinds of tactics and things we were doing, either in pitching business or how we were just communicating, I think, in general in the industry, some of that I look back and go, wow, things have really changed. And other times you look back and go, yeah, the industry could still use quite a bit more change, couldn't it? And but when I think about, you know, in those early days, it was, you know, writing pitches and presentations and proposals, and, you know, we were still binding things in books and couriering them. I remember I had to get on a plane one time to fly a set of proposals to the client because we missed the deadline for shipping and we couldn't get it overnighted.
Done that, yep.
So then if you really wanted to differentiate, you might hire a video crew and put a film together of the CEO talking about why the project is important to the company. But that was leading edge back then. You couldn't shoot it on your iPhone in the hallway. It took a lot of work and time. You know, today, obviously, you know what I'm going to say. It's everything's digital. Everything is happens in an instant. I mean, social media came together over those 20 years. And I remember going in, I was working for a fairly large commercial real estate services company at the time, not Cushman & Wakefield. But I went in, and this is probably 2003 or so. And I went into one of the executives in the business, and I said, I think our company should start a blog. He said, well, what's a blog? I said, well, it's this new kind of communication style that it's usually used in a person-to-person basis, and it takes on a first-person narrative, but now companies are starting to use it. And I had my little PowerPoint slide ready with look at General Motors and look at Boeing, and different companies are using this to express a different side of their brand voice that doesn't meet the traditional, you know, press release or advertisement. And I got this very warm reception. It was like, you're really pushing the boundaries. Thanks so much, but we don't want to do it. Okay. Back to the drawing board, right? And you know, I think that's just probably a part of, you know, being young in your career and being okay that you're going to have some great idea and the company's not going to want to do it. But there, I would say, you know, in that period, that 15 years ago, there was just no appetite to try things new in our industry. And if I flash forward today, I might give a presentation in front of a group of senior execs or clients in our industry, and I'm now talking about like the things we're doing, you know, through social media or how we're using artificial intelligence to track, you know, behavior and movements on different web platforms that we have, which can give us analytics and maybe tell a landlord what some of the tenant demand looks like in a given submarket of a city. And we're presenting that now. We're not selling the concept anymore. The customer or the executive, they want to go right to the data. Like, what do you have? Show me what you've got. And so whether it was just through osmosis or whether, you know, there was some kind of coming of age as an industry, there's definitely an appetite now, I think, for digital. So that whole thing has come full circle.
So, Brad, we've been talking a lot about this sort of fast, flat, deep impact of technology and digital. What the sort of, from a marketing point of view, maybe you've got an example of something that talks to that digital transformation that's so crucial for people to understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the idea that everything in life now begins with a Google search, right? From ordering a pizza to making a very complex decision, everything kind of begins and ends digital. And when I talk about this, I like to think of a couple of just analogs in the industry or outside of the industry. So if you ever bought a car in the last couple of years, I want you to think about the process that you went through. And if you go back about 20, 25 years, how did we buy cars? You'd walk out to a car lot, a little person would come out of the house and they'd talk to you for a bit, and they were pre-qualifying you, asking you questions about where you go and do you have a family and how far do you drive. Then they would recommend, you know, different models, different ideas of things that would meet your needs. You'd haggle over a price, maybe take a test drive and buy a car. Think about how that works today. The process is completely different. And so it's mostly an online journey today that may or may not be completely online or fulfilled offline at the dealership. So think about it. You go online and, you know, maybe you're like subscribing to a car. Volvo has subscription models now for different cars, or you're leasing, or all of these different kind of ownership structures. But you're halfway through, you know, the intended length of term you're going to own the car. You're already online thinking about your next purchase, and these websites are great. You're putting different wheels on and changing the colors and changing the options, and you're sort of having this kind of entertainment experience. Then as you get more serious, you maybe narrow down the field and you have a couple ideas of what you'd like. Maybe you're putting stuff out over Twitter or social media, asking your networks to give you advice, and your brother-in-law comes back and tells you not to buy this model because he had problems with it. And so you're using kind of a social digital network to make decisions. Then right before you're ready to purchase, you're going to go do all of your pricing exercise, and you're going to look, you know, how much should you pay, where should you go, et cetera. Some people might procure the car online today, but most people still go to the dealership, I think is what the research shows. So the minute you walk onto the dealership, not a whole lot's changed in the last 20 years. The person still comes out of the house. They're like, I want to ask you a few questions. How are we doing today? And you throw up the hands right away and you say, stop. I want this model in this color with these options. I don't want those options. And here's the price I'm willing to pay. And if you don't say yes, I'm going two towns over to the dealership because I've checked all of your prices and I know what you're up to. And at that point, the problem with that is that person isn't a salesperson anymore. They're just like a fulfillment agent. And so I think as marketers, for us, what we have to think about is a lot of the onus in that relationship between marketing and sales and the consumer. Clearly, the balance of power now is with the consumer, but the process has shifted to more of an online process, more of a marketing process. And so I think in the context of B2B business, the same absolutely holds true. And as you know, our clients are out making decisions around, you know, should they, you know, renew their lease? Should they move their office? What's happening demographically in their central business district? What are commuter patterns, you know, looking like? And right. they're asking all of those questions through digital channels, and they want answers to those. And I think, you know, for those of us in the industry, the ones that have the expertise to be able to answer that, as marketers, my job is to try to get that intellectual property out of human heads and into digital channels so that we can meet our customers' needs right then and there when they have them. And that, again, that's a total transformation, I think, from what at least our function of marketing looked like 10 or 15 years ago.
It is, and it's all, and we've talked about this as well, it's all about the data points. It's having much more than just, I need 10,000 square feet of office space. As you say, it's about the labor analytics, the location, the transport patterns. And all that data is now readily available. And so we need people who think about that first, almost, and then the building structure itself second. And the information we want about the building is it LEED Platinum? Is it got is it fit well? You know, what's the air conditioning system? Is it recycling? Is it buying green energy? It's all those data points that now make up a sale in the real estate industry, not, do you like the look of the floor plate? Is the ceiling height
that's
good
right.
enough? And the air conditioning's in the ceiling, that's okay,
and
isn't it?
And it's not the either-or proposition like we were talking
exactly.
about. It's not, you know, am I going to solve all of my real estate needs through Google, or will I solve them through a great relationship with a person? It's both. But the problem is, you know, the industry has grown up in a human analog only way. So all of the information is trapped in cells and DNA, and we've got to get it out of those brains and into digital channels so that as an industry, we can continue to evolve and the information can flow freely. I think that's the challenge.
And maybe we can sort of dig into that a little bit more, because when we were chatting earlier, we were talking about how the industry at the individual level has changed from it being kind of father to son, and you know, business was done on the golf course and it was who you knew and very much not what you knew. And maybe, do you think it's because the industry is getting more diverse and there's more people with different backgrounds and talents coming into it that allow people to be more open? Or is it more just, if you're not, the world's just run past you? Whereas, I mean, I've been working for longer than you, and your story resonates. And I mean, I started in the mid-80s, and yeah, you did kind of what you were told. And if you stepped out of line, you were hit on the head and put back in line. So it, for me, there's been an even bigger shift from that old world of doing it to the new world.
Certainly, but I think there's a few things at play, and you have to look, there's certainly a demographic shift happening in the workforce today, and I want to talk about that in a second, but our industry is shifting too. And I think as our industry matures and kind of goes through that maturity curve from something that's highly localized, and you probably only got into real estate if you grew up in the business, and if you think about like the landlords and owners of buildings 30 years ago, 50 years ago, being mostly individuals, mostly sort of, you know, localized ownership, to something that feels very institutional and something that, you know, major institutions who think about things beyond the transaction, like how to manage risk and how to manage reputation. They want to do business with companies that have a broader platform and a broader sort of, you know, higher degree of professionalism. And I think that's, you know, we all see it. It's driven consolidation in our industry. It's driven a very different approach to how we sell and how we provide services. And I think as that happens, then you immediately go to, well, it's not just about the transaction, or it's not just about the specific real estate skill that made us so successful in the past. Now we need a whole diversity of skill sets to make this large organization work. And some of that's not indifferent from how other big, you know, world-class and professional services businesses work. And so I think that that going on at the same time with this new kind of demographic shift, which, you know, if you look at some of the data and some of the things we're paying attention to right now, there was a pretty big study done fairly recently that showed by the year 2030, 800 million baby boomers will leave the global workforce. And that's a big deal. But even bigger so, to be replaced by 1.3 billion Generation Z folks that are coming into the workforce. And in the middle of that, in between those two bookends, you have the millennials. And everyone has talked and written and read about that millennial generation. The interesting thing is, if you ask, if you look and you study and you kind of break the millennial generation down, the 30-year-olds are the largest cohort in the workforce today, followed by the 29-year-olds, followed by the 27-year-olds, the 31-year-olds. That whole kind of group bucketed around, you know, 27 to 30-year-olds. There are more of those working in the global world today than any other age group. So if we think about this for a second, and the boomers retire over 10 years' time, the millennials, the oldest millennial in 10 years is 50 years old. And I'm not sure if, you know, anyone's ever thought that was possible, right? And if you think about that. So what does it mean when millennials are the new C-suite running not only, you know, companies in our industry, but they're our clients and they're running, you know, the business world everywhere? You start thinking about like, well, what do millennials care about today? And Deloitte did a really interesting study this year. They surveyed thousands of millennials across 42 countries, and they showed that everything that you thought to be true came through the data. And it said that millennials care today when they do business with other companies or they choose companies they want to work for. Social impact is just as important as business performance or financial performance. And we see that evident, I think, throughout the media and throughout, you know, society today. So if all of that happens and we think about a world in 10 years that business, major business, is being run by people who care about social impact, and the other majority of the younger part of that workforce are digital natives who've grown up in a world where they've only known social media to exist, not even the internet, but they've only known a world through the lens of social media. How does that change how we communicate? How does it change how we incentivize people, how we make decisions in business? it will radically change, I think, how things happen. And if, you know, those of us who are thinking about this stuff now, we can prepare, we can start to evolve the industry. And I think it's maybe some of that in combination with the professionalization of the industry that's just driving change, whether or not, you know, those that sort of hold the power of business today want to change it or not. It's just a natural evolution. I think it's just happening.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Maybe a couple of anecdotes. I was at an academy school in London yesterday. I'm doing something effectively a free school. And the woman I met came over and was meeting me and a couple of students, and she brought over water. And the first thing she did was apologize because it was single-use plastic. And she said, "I'm sorry, this is all we have, and I know I shouldn't really be giving it to you," which I thought was incredible. And these two 17-year-old kids were looking at her kind of in the head. The bubble would have said, "Yeah, why haven't you changed it?" That's the first time that's ever happened to me. I mean, people are so aware of that type of stuff. And in the business context, you don't want to do business with people who don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, I look at all these studies because they just reinforce, I think, what we all kind of see every day, like the anecdote you just shared. And one of them said, for Generation Z, when they come into the workforce, they're going to choose a company to work for based on how sophisticated the company is. Like, it wasn't even just about they need to have technology or they need to have, it's a whole kind of worldview, and it needs to be a sophisticated view that, you know, equality is, you know, men and women are treated equally at the company and everyone has sort of equal opportunity, that technology is ubiquitous, that, you know, I can manage my work and my life, that the company cares about the communities and the impact it's making around itself in the world. And there's just a whole kind of social profile of sophistication that the companies that aren't able to articulate that or don't believe it or don't exhibit it, they just won't, there won't be anyone left to work there.
And I think it's going towards the individual, which poses a huge number of problems. And maybe we can come on to that. And again, I'll use an example to get us to that conversation. But there's a New York Times writer, foreign correspondent called Thomas Friedman, and he talks about the change since 2000. So I guess the time you went, and he talks about the internet coming along and that being fast. So the internet brought speed to everything that we did. He then says the world shifted into flat, and by flat he meant it was everywhere. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, you can get hold of the technology and do stuff. So we see, you know, banking being done in Africa, not along wires, but wirelessly, and leapfrogging what's been happening in the more developed world. And now he talks about deep, and deep means the individual. So you take the fast and you take the flat, and then you go into the individual. So he's talking about things like clothing that you wear, that sports people have been wearing now for a number of years, which track how much you perspire, how many miles you run in a soccer game, whatever it happens to be. Clothing that responds to the temperature outside to keep you at a constant temperature. So actually, we're making this incredibly complex world because we have the data, which you talked about, and we have the technology to allow us to monitor everything. And so when I think about that in terms of real estate and the work that we do and everyone else is doing, people want different, you know, you read about different temperatures for men versus women, for instance, and heating different parts of buildings to different temperatures, depending on what the work is that's going on. And you kind of wonder where that's going to end, because the fast and the flat is still happening. So the speed hasn't dropped away. That's now a given. The flat's given. But now it's how far can we go with this? And what on earth that means for us as individuals in buildings is one thing. And also where people in those millennials, where do they go with their careers?
It's funny. I heard a futurist at a conference I was at a few weeks ago. And he gave one of those just, you know, great little nuggets that you walk away with and go, oh, I'm going to find a place to use this again. Maybe someone will invite me to a podcast soon. But he said,
here you are.
He said, you know, how many people show of hands who thinks like 2019, like, could it get any faster? Could the trends coming at you, you know, flying cars and clothing that changes temperature, whatever you want to talk about, you can like put a basket of ideas together and someone's going to go, boy, this couldn't get any faster. And he goes, well, get ready, because 2019 will be the slowest rate of change for the next 20 years. It's an accelerating curve. So the other example that I thought was interesting is same kind of concept, but if you look at Amazon and you think about, you know, the Amazon effect on our daily lives, I see something, I want it, I touch, it's on my door a day later. Like that has changed how consumer behavior happens. And if you talk to people and you say, wow, this e-commerce thing must be, we've hit a peak, or it couldn't get any crazier than this. And I heard Amazon is taking a drone and they want to drop it at your house. And then you look at the actual stats, and our retail business tracks a lot of this, and you look at the relatively small percentage of e-commerce that still makes up retail today. Yeah. I mean, it's less than 20% of what does life look like when 80% of commerce is e-commerce? Like, who knows, right? So I guess it's evolution, but it's at an increasingly evolving rate. And I think if we're not comfortable and confident enough to just work through that, but also still tether back to the things that don't always change, which is sort of like connecting on a human level and trying to make sure that, you know, we can remain grounded in values and things that are important as we think about, you know, our different constituencies, whether they're clients or our employees, et cetera. There's some things that don't change too. And so I think if you don't get scared by kind of the tactical piece that's changing around us, but rather you kind of roll with the change and embrace it and kind of change and adapt and change and adapt, but stay focused on the things that are probably, you know, truisms that don't really change. And I think, you know, for millennials or for anyone early in their career who's trying to navigate through everything today, the change piece maybe comes easier for them because they've been living with it more regularly. But you can really differentiate yourself if you've got a strong, you know, drive and ambition and personality, and you can be a really good listener and you can articulate what you want to do. And those things, you know, they haven't changed, in my opinion.
Yeah, and if you look at Pearson did a very interesting study on the future of work, and I know a number of people have done it, but they were looking, because they're an educational company and their vision statement is digital first. So, you know, sort of the death of the written book. You can get a book from them if you want, but you get digital first. And they did the research to see what sort of jobs were around, and this whole idea of lifelong learning, but empathy, the ability to have empathy, to talk to people, those are the jobs that probably can't be replicated by machines, and are so incredibly important to us as humans that's where some of this is going. So you can imagine lots of surgery being done by machines because you're knocked out anyway, so you don't need someone to talk to you. But then there's maybe in the real estate world where a lot of it is still done by talking to people and negotiating and stuff. It needs more of those types of skills.
Yeah, I think, you know, as long as the urban center continues to be this thriving place where all of these different, you know, social and economic and, you know, factors are coming together on a daily basis, there's always going to be a need for human discernment to help make decisions in a growing kind of complex world. That doesn't mean we can't take advantage of all of the trends and all of the good things that things like automation and AI and robotics can help us with. And if you look at robotics, for example, a robot is better at making decisions when you don't want judgment to cloud a decision, when it's just a, you know, it's a fact-based decision. Yep. And they have a great repeatable reliance that they don't make, you know, quote unquote human errors. But at this point in time, AI is not really great at dealing with emotion and dealing with, you know, complex emotional, you know, human issues. So there's always going to be a place. And that's why I don't buy into these arguments of we should be afraid of technology, or we should shy away, or we're gonna, or this idea that if we could only go back, then we'll get back to the good old days. Like, I think it's a constant, you know, state of change. And if we rely on our humanity to continue to be the thread through progress and evolution, and you know, the technology thing has been in play for ages, right?
Yeah, and then if you look at where technology's one aspect of where technology's going, which is voice. I mean, 5 years ago, if I'd said you'd have a machine in your house you talked to and it ordered your groceries, everyone would have laughed. And now we have it, and we have multiple ones, and they're going to get more and more ubiquitous everywhere. And so all the companies that sell have to now get their brands out via that medium. So, you know, you talk about you don't want to order soap, you want to order a brand of soap. So brand and marketing is as if not more important. But we're taking technology back, if you like, almost full circle, because it's now, I want to be able to talk to the machine, not just have the machine do something. So it's back to this in verbal communication, albeit one half of the communications with a machine, but that's preferable to me just coding something in, which is the way we did it 5, 10, 15 years ago. So you just take that forward 5 years and you wonder where we're going to get to with voice and what it's going to be able to do for us. I mean, we'll go into office buildings and say, lower the temperature, and the temperature will come down. We'll say, book me a conference room, and it will be happening. I mean, there's all sorts of sort of stuff that will happen. So I think we're going to get back in a way that, well, part of that human element in a funny way.
The technology, isn't a physical impediment anymore, right? It's just a part of what we do, right? When you think about, you know, you walk into a room and you say, a little cooler, I'm a little warm right now. You're not holding a device. It's not distracting you. It just becomes sort of ubiquitous with how we do life. And I completely think that. I often will give talks and we'll talk about, you know, and maybe this is in a room of, you know, either real estate folks or folks who've been in the industry for a while. And I'll say, hey, has anyone ever been at a function where you're at a cocktail and you're talking to your client or you're talking to your colleague and you say, you know, my kid's doing some really interesting stuff on, you know, Instagram or on Snapchat, and oh yeah, you should see, and I'll show you my kid's page, and you're sort of having this sort of like proud, you know, moment of, you know, look how they're embracing technology. Again, in like 10 years, that conversation will never be had. And I often say it's sort of like today, you don't walk into a room and go, oh, Michael just flipped that switch. Look how the lights came on. That's really interesting. Like, it's just a ubiquitous part of life. And we're already there, right? And the idea that, again, you need a bar of soap, you touch it, and it'll show up on your door the next day. Like 20 years ago, that would have been ludicrous. You'd never thought, how would they get the supply chain? How would that work? The technology, you know, e-commerce, and it's happened. So I think it's just becoming normal and naturalized. And I think the more, you know, the rate of pace and as change continues on technology, hopefully it just becomes more natural. But it's interesting.
It is. And maybe just to wrap up, a couple of thoughts around something that's sort of near and dear to my heart, but sort of lifelong learning is something that's come into the, if you like, the mainstream vernacular in the last few years, because people are living for longer. So it's about leaving. You know, I grew up in a world where you worked and then you retired at 60, and that was kind of how things gone. That's yesterday, right? And people take career breaks, go off and learn a new language, learn a different discipline, which is the whole lifelong learning piece. And then maybe couple that with the sort of the classic question, if I'm 18 years old and I'm thinking of going to university and I think I want a career in property, do I need to do a degree in technology? Or is technology, as you said, just we're going to be talking, so we don't actually need to know how to use technology because it's going to be so easy to use? I mean, what would you recommend someone studied at university to help them get into a career in property? And other than, so the answer can't be property. Well, it could be, but I don't think that's the answer.
Yeah, look, I mean, we're going to need every kind of person in this industry, from, you know, really, really thoughtful, you know, sort of financial engineers and you know, finance backgrounds, to data scientists, to data analytics, to, you know, computer scientists. It's all of the above. And I think if you're starting from the point where you want to go into property and you're considering a university career, we've done something right as an industry. Yeah. And I actually think we probably have the opposite issue. Today, what we need to do is go, why should a data scientist person work for the real estate industry and not the tech industry? And we need to make a compelling argument. I think there is an argument there. It's a really interesting industry, and there's nothing more tangible than the built environment around us. And there's nothing more interesting about life than how life works in a city and the microcosm of everything that happens there. And when you work in property, at least at this part of the industry, you get to look and touch that every day. And it is that human connection, because it's all of the people that are making decisions around that and getting things to work. And that's really exciting stuff. And then if you play that into like the university, we need so many diverse kinds of people coming into this industry. And, you know, diversity and inclusion often get written off as sort of a corporate value, to right, kind of an altruistic thing, but it's actually real. Like, we need people who can take apart a really complex issue and think about it not just from a property angle, but from, again, a psychological angle, a societal angle, a technological angle. And so I think for those of us in this industry, and if that's, you know, most of the group listening to this podcast, like, we all have to make a compelling argument to the broader community. But in order to do that and to have, you know, actual authenticity as we're making that argument. We can't do it as a group of older white males who only are used to doing business in one way and kind of in the style that you were describing when you grew up in the business. And so that's the case. Like, if we don't change the way we talk, the way we communicate, if we don't change the things we actually value and bring equality into the workplace and really lead this, we're never going to attract folks into this industry. And actually, we should be concerned for the that demographic shift that I'm talking about, because when, you know, those 800 million people leave the industry, there's a whole lot of empty chairs in our field. So it's just for anybody listening to this, you know, I can't say enough, and I try to talk to our own teams, and our management team is very tuned into this right now, that, you know, we have to focus on the younger generations and make our industry relevant so that we can recruit them in and continue to be relevant as an organization.
Brad, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating conversation. I know we could probably talk about this for hours, but our time's up. So appreciate you coming to London and spending time with us and for doing this podcast. Thank you.
I love the show. And you know, when you think about connecting to different generations, it's cool to use different mediums. And I like what you're doing. So thanks for having me. It was great.
Great. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Cheers.